Hey, everybody. Welcome to the NFL Roadshow as we turn the page to week 14. Week 14. Can you believe it? Good grief. And remember, there's 18 weeks this year. I have to constantly remind myself that. Anyway, there are some good matchups this week. Four, by my count, that pit current playoff teams against one another. We've got the Cowboys and the Washington football team. We've got the Niners and the Bengals. They are both currently in playoff spots in their respective conferences. The Bills and the Bucks play each other. That game is expected to go over 50 points. I think it's at 50 and a half on Tuesday afternoon. And the Rams and Cardinals, which is also at 50 and a half, the over-under there. Those are the only two games that are expected to go over 50 points, by the way, this week. And both of the home teams are favored by 3 in each of those two matchups. And then we've got the Ravens and the Browns playing each other. I think that that game will be fun to watch. The Steelers and the Vikings should be competitive. And the Raiders and Chiefs. And I bring that one up because, you know, weird things happen in that matchup. It's also the last week of byes with 4 teams off this week. We've got the Colts, Dolphins, Eagles, and Patriots all out of the mix. So remember to take them out of your fantasy lineups, though we'll get more into that on Friday's episode. The Patriots, by the way, now have sole possession of first place in the AFC following that sludge fest on Monday. But are they the best team in the AFC? I know we all have our opinions, and they're fun to discuss. And since there's so much randomness that happens in this game of football, I'm not sure that any opinions are actually more valid than others. But you guys know me. I love learning. I love football. I love learning about football. So I'm always interested to hear from people who study the game in a different way than I do about the information that they've come up with and how it influences their expectations and opinions about what's likely to happen moving forward. And so I'm excited about my guest today, because he comes to the table with a lot of tangible information that I think the rest of us can factor into our own mental equations about who's good, who's not, and the reasons why we feel that way. He is one of the founding fathers, so to speak, of football analytics. Having launched his website, Football Outsiders, back in 2003, he came up with some of the metrics that many analysts now use to evaluate and predict play. His name is Aaron Schatz, and we are going to cover a ton of ground. Who the best teams are in the NFL, who the most overrated teams are in the NFL, maybe some teams that aren't getting enough credit for what they are doing quietly. I guess that would make them underrated teams. Who are the best coaches in the NFL, and which positions are most impactful in the NFL? You know quarterback's going to be at the top of the list, but what's after that? I think that you will find the way he presents his information appealing, in the sense that he presents it as just that. It's information and not gospel truth. You're going to hear him several times suggest that there is more to the story than his numbers tell. And if you are at all like me, I think you will find his numbers very interesting. So without further ado, let's break the huddle and enjoy this left brain boost. It's Aaron Schatz.
Hurry up, let's go!
2-1, 2-1, 2. Ready? Three.
Welcome to the show, Aaron. Thank you so much for making time to talk to me.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's always good to be on.
So I have so many questions for you, and I'm really eager to see things through the lens that you look at it through. Coming off, obviously, a very vital game in the AFC. I quoted last week some of the Football Outsiders' predictions in terms of probabilities about the Patriots' chances to get the one seed if they won that game and if they lost that game. So what did that game on Monday night do to the playoff picture in terms of your projections?
Yeah, now listen, we have to acknowledge the fact that we have the Patriots higher than everyone else. It feels like they're a little bit too high. I mean, I know my numbers are based on lots of research over lots of years, but we're a bit out of step with the market and even a little bit out of step with other advanced analytics sites. So take this with a small grain of salt. But we now have the Patriots getting the number one seed in 66% of our simulations. And we actually have them winning the Super Bowl 1/3 of the time.
What?
In our weighted ratings, the ones that lower the weight of games from earlier in the season, the Patriots are way ahead of everybody else, like way ahead of everybody else. They are, since week 4, so since the beginning of October, They are the number three offense and the number one defense. And that includes two losses. That includes the losses to Dallas and Tampa Bay and the fairly unimpressive Houston win. And then all the wins they've had on this winning streak, including just colossal wins over Cleveland and Tennessee that do fabulous in our number. They just come out that much ahead of everybody else if you lower the weight of early games a little bit. And so we have their chances of winning the Super Bowl just far higher than anyone else. And I understand that it seems screwy. And my guess is that we have it a little bit too high, that I should be including some sort of variable for just how good the quarterback is that would boost the Chiefs and lower the Patriots a little bit. But even if we did that, I think we would have the Patriots higher than the market at this point. They've just been that good.
Well, and I wonder how you even do that, because the thing about Mac Jones is clearly from an eye test standpoint, you're not putting him in the same tier as Patrick Mahomes, right? He's not going to make those plays out of thin air, but also this offense doesn't ask him to. The offense, he is very, very good at what this offense asks him to do. So how do you punish him, you know, for not being flashy when more often than not, he's not asked to be flashy and they're winning games without him being flashy?
I mean, I think the idea is not punishing him, but reward, you know, that perhaps our ratings need to reward Patrick Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers for their resumes, for the fact that we've known for multiple years that they have been the most efficient quarterbacks in football at moving the ball, at moving things forward. And as much as the Patriots offense does not ask Mac Jones to do more than he can, you would rather have an offense that's like the Chiefs of the last 3 years, right? Like, that's still better. But what the Patriots have put on the field and the way that they've run the ball has been, like I just said, the number three most efficient offense in the league since the beginning of October. That's out of 10 games.
Would there be a stronger likelihood that somebody like an Aaron Rodgers or a Patrick Mahomes, although you look at them and you say, okay, they're going to pick up a chunk yards and they're going to make plays, there's also probably a greater probability that something will happen that they do that will hurt their team too, right? Than Mac Jones?
Maybe. I mean, look, the fact is it was 11 weeks ago, but the Saints game still like does tell us something about Mac Jones, and he made a number of mistakes in that game. So I don't know if Mahomes and Rodgers are that much more likely. You know, they have the gunslinger mentality, but I think the positives way outweigh the possible negatives. I think it's good that Mac Jones sort of plays within himself, but there are errors to be made by him too.
Okay. I'm trying to find ways for the model to make sense in this scenario.
The defense is really good. The defense is really, really good. The running game is really, really good. The special teams is really, really good. Like, I understand questioning it because the quarterback is the most important and predictive part of the team. But in every other way, the Patriots have been pretty much the best team in the league for 10 weeks.
Who's number two?
Tampa.
And then 3, 4, 5?
Buffalo. I mean, for example, if you look at weighted DVOA, right, which lowers the weight of early games, we have New England 1, Tampa Bay 2, Dallas 3, and Buffalo 4. But Dallas and Buffalo are basically tied. Then we have San Francisco.
What?
And Indianapolis basically tied at 5, with Arizona right behind them. But of course, with an asterisk, because the three of those games had Colt McCoy, quarterback, with no DeAndre Hopkins.
Explain the San Francisco one to me.
San Francisco has been really good. San Francisco has played a lot of close games. They've had a very tough schedule. They have very poor luck recovering fumbles. They've had more turnovers than they should have had, and they've had fewer takeaways than they should have had. They've been playing at a very high level. Like, a lot of weird stuff happened in this week's game with Seattle, but like that aside, San Francisco has been playing at a really high level.
Okay. You didn't say Kansas City there. Where are they?
The Kansas City would be 9th in weighted DVOA. Their offense, you know, we keep feeling like, oh, the offense has gotten back. they got back in those two games, the Raiders game that I was at, and then the Dallas Cowboys game. So we have the Raiders game and the Dallas Cowboys game, but even in the Dallas game, they only scored 19 points. And then their offense wasn't that impressive in the Denver game. What's impressive is their defense. If you look since like week six, Kansas City actually has the second best defense in the league behind New England. So we all believe in our hearts that Kansas City is going to get it together. Mm-hmm. We all feel like, oh, they're going to get it together. Like the talent is still there and Mahomes is still Mahomes and the offensive line has played well. And God, look at what a great rookie season Creed Humphrey has had. And like, we all believe that the offense is going to get it together, but based on the actual performance on the field in 2021, they would not come out as one of the five best teams in the league.
Looking at Patrick Mahomes, just from a fantasy standpoint, and I know that that doesn't tell, you know, a story, but kind of based on expectations for Patrick Mahomes, he had 12 fantasy points last week. He had 7 the week before. Like, he had 10 in week 9. He had 14 in week 8. He had 7 in week 7. He had a big blow up against the Raiders. But like, it's just, it's not playing out the way that we are used to seeing it play out there in Kansas City offensively. And that's, you know, just one other way to kind of make that point.
My friends and I play in a fantasy league called the Multi-League.
Okay.
We draft players from basketball, football, and baseball together.
What?
And then whoever does the best in the three leagues combined wins. And I started my drafts this year with a Mahomes Kelsey stack for my NFL team. It has not worked.
It has not. Why wouldn't you go running back? I would think as an analytics person, it feels like
it's
the entire fantasy
league. Quarterback. The football league is a 2-quarterback league.
There you go. That makes sense. All right. We've said it several times. I want to just clarify for people who are listening who do not know what we're talking about. When you say DVOA, what does that stand for? What does it mean?
So DVOA stands for defense adjusted value over average, but it's really just opponent adjusted value over average. We take every play, we assign it success points based on how successful it is, considering the down and distance. Obviously, you get penalized for turnovers or losses. Then that gets compared to a league average baseline that is adjusted for situation and opponent. So it basically tells you how efficient you are, both in getting yards and in moving the sticks. Anything above zero is good offense. Anything below zero is good defense.
Have you found this to consistently tell you who the best teams and the worst teams are? Is it consistently predictive in that way?
Yeah. I mean, we try to make it predictive and there's tweaks that I can make. You know, I've always looking at ways to tweak it to make it more predictive in the future. When it started out, it was sort of trying to be halfway between being predictive and being, you know, looking at the past and correlating
reflective.
The actual wins.
Yeah.
And over time, we've worked it to become more and more predictive. I think it's one of, if not the best advanced metric out there. The opponent adjustments is a really valuable thing to have compared to like raw EPA, which gets quoted on Twitter a lot. And I have been doing this for a long time, and we've had pretty good success with it. That being said, there's a lot of randomness in the NFL. So even our predictions are wrong a lot of the time.
Yeah, anyone who plays fantasy football knows that, right? Like, you do all this work, you could have all of the process could be right, and then there's so much randomness that happens on a Sunday. Going back to the rankings of, you know, the teams that are near the top for you, we left off at Kansas City, number 9. Another team I did not hear you say there was Baltimore. Where is Baltimore now?
Baltimore is down at 16th right now.
16th. Where were they last week?
Last week in weighted DVOA, they were 13th.
Oh, so they didn't even drop that much.
No, a little bit. It's my ratings work very gradually once you get to this point in the season, because you're still considering even the weighted ratings that lower the weight of the early games, you're still considering 12 games.
Right.
So if you've got 12 games that you're considering, adding one doesn't change things that much. So things change kind of slowly. But for the season, Baltimore is actually average on offense and slightly below average on defense, which is a little bit of a surprise. And then number 1 on special teams because they're Baltimore. And even though special teams are the least consistent of the three phases and the hardest to predict, Baltimore and New England are always good on special teams, especially Baltimore.
Let me ask you this then, because one of the conversations that we had over the weekend about their decision to go for two was so many people saying the Ravens are the better team. And that's obvious. And that was why they should have played for overtime. How much better are they than the Steelers in your model in that regard?
Because we have the Steelers 23rd.
Okay. So they're better, but
they're better.
16 and 23 doesn't feel like the slam dunk that I think a lot of people think that the Ravens are like a top five team and the Steelers are probably around 23rd.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I think, you know, going into the game, you would have seen the gap is larger. You would have seen it as like 13 versus 23 or something.
True.
And also Baltimore has the better kicker, and that matters for winning in overtime, right? They're going to be able to attempt longer field goals. They're more likely to hit the field goals. It's an interesting decision because most of the analytic models out there believed that they made a mistake.
Isn't that funny? Because everyone said, oh, analytics, and blamed the decision on analytics, when in fact that's what I saw too, right? Edge Sports and Next Gen Stats, they were tweeting out right away, like, we think that the right call was to kick.
It was a gut decision. And it was a gut decision based primarily on what was going on with this defensive personnel. And I think that a lot of the model, it was close, right? This is the kind of decision where the models don't tell you definitely to do one thing or the other, that you use your gut. And he went with his gut because he felt that his defense was going to struggle if they had to get back on the field. And he felt that he had a play that would work. And he had an open receiver, right? That play worked. The receiver was open. It's just the pressure got to Jackson and he missed him by like 3 inches.
You know what I would be curious to know is whether I would like to ask him, if the defense hadn't been a factor, what do you think the likelihood is that you would have made the same decision? Because yeah, it's kind of consistent with some of the decision-making that he's made in the past. And I know that maybe the analytics were on board with, like, I think it was week two against the Chiefs when he went for it on fourth and one, effectively setting up a winning field goal for the Chiefs if they didn't get it. So in that sense, he makes these types of calls where he goes, you guys go make the play. I trust you to make it. And he's super aggressive like that. So I don't know that I completely buy that he wouldn't have done this anyway, even if the cornerback situation hadn't been what it was. And I would like to hear his thought process.
His answer probably would be, you know, I can't deal in hypotheticals. I can only really tell you about what was happening in this game. That would probably be his answer. But I may just be jaded because I live in New England and I'm used to Bill Belichick answers during press conferences. So
They're a little different. I'm curious about how much the Ravens hurt themselves in your model with that loss, as opposed to if they had won. So they dropped from 13th to 16th. That's not incredibly dramatic. How much do you think a win would have helped them?
Well, I mean, the way that it works is that we're looking at every play. So I don't actually consider 2-point conversions because they're so rare. So if they had gotten that 2-point conversion, their DVOA would have been exactly the same as it was out of that game, because I don't consider that play. Now, if they had won by 7 or won by 14, things would be different because they would have had more successful plays during the game and thus their rating would be higher. Well, I mean, the goal is to win the game. So the question is, do you think you're more likely to win the game if it goes to overtime, or are you more likely to convert the two? And they decided they were more likely to convert the two. And a lot of the math models think they were more likely to win the game if it went to overtime. But I totally understand. I mean, I really do totally understand the decision that he made, because, you know, they'd had a successful drive. They felt they had a play that worked. He felt that if we lose the coin toss and we have to put our defense on the field, we're in big trouble. Like, I totally understand the decision that he made. But the fact is, it means a lot, because the race for the number one seed is going to be so close, and the number one seed matters so much that every win and loss is hugely important. I mean, when N'Keal Harry had that ball go off his mask on Monday night, like, I thought, oh, well, this is going to totally turn the race for the number one seed if the Patriots lose this game, because that ball glanced off his mask. Like, every game involving the top five teams in the AFC really top six, since the Chargers are only a game back of the Chiefs and could definitely go on a run and win the number one seed. Like, every game really matters.
You have Tampa Bay as number two. So how many times in your simulations do Tampa Bay and New England play in the Super Bowl? How likely is that?
15.2%.
Would that be fun?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if it would just be like, if the hype would be so agonizing.
Right.
That, like, you couldn't take it. Like, you're desperate for something else, like a Kansas City Green Bay matchup or something.
Yes.
Or it would just be so perfect. I mean, what I don't like that idea simply because I don't like the idea that a Super Bowl between Brady and Belichick will decide for good which one of them was more important, because that's not how it really works.
No, it's so gross. And then we'd have to have the same conversations about legacies and those two and rehash every single storyline that we've already rehashed for the last decade.
I think that what this year and what Belichick has done with the Patriots has helped demonstrate is, if that team had only Brady, they wouldn't have won it. They would have won it a couple times. And if that team had only Belichick, they would have won it a couple of times. But totally. To do what they did over a 20-year period, they needed to have both of them.
I do love that, just in terms of putting a button on that storyline that we're going to have, whether you and I want to have it or not, that Belichick has done what he's done this year, so that after the grossness of last year and Tampa Bay winning the Super Bowl and the way that that turned the conversation into, well, I guess it was Brady. Like, the fact that Belichick has come right back and built himself a Super Bowl caliber squad that looks the way it does. I think that's the craziest thing, is that we have to give so much of the credit this year to Belichick for them winning, because he doesn't have a Tom Brady. He's a rookie at quarterback. When you look at the weapons that he has, it's like Nelson Aguilar and Kendrick Bourne. And you're like, who are these people? You know what I mean? Like, they're not these big stars. He hasn't done it in that way. This is coaching. This is them putting this roster together. Never mind the fact that he literally put it together in free agency and went out and made the moves that have got them where they are. So that aspect, I think, is interesting. And you could even have the conversation in gross if we have to have it leading up to the Super Bowl, but it's a little bit more interesting than in years past. The, like, which one is actually more important? More impressive, because Tom Brady went to Tampa and pulled all these stars. You know what I mean? Like, he's got a great roster and a good coach and the whole thing is there. And he's certainly a hugely important part of it. But like, the way Belichick's doing it this year, I think there's an interesting conversation there.
As an analytics person, I want to feel like a big part of coaching is the fourth down decisions, because we harp on it so much. And Belichick has been terribly conservative on fourth downs for the last couple of years. But that aside, he's coach of the year. Like, it's not, I mean, at this point, I don't think it's a question. He's, even if he doesn't win the number one seed with a rookie quarterback, he's coming close to winning the number one seed with a rookie quarterback.
Yeah.
That's, and he's coaching that team to be able to play in different ways, in different circumstances, against different types of opponents. He's very, the way that he's so flexible and so successful at being flexible, he should win coach of the year this year.
And then the fact that, so after, on Tuesday morning, he comes out talking about that Monday game and he gave us some slight insight, like the, in a way that he does not typically do, in terms of saying, what do you have left? I forget what the question was exactly, but kind of like something that you gained by the game playing out the way that it did. And he revealed, we didn't show them any of our pass plays. We've got all of that in our back pocket, ready to roll out, and they will have never seen it before. And I thought that was more revealing than he typically is about strategic things.
I would guess that the rematch in 3 weeks is not include only three pass plays, by the way.
Well, props to him if he can find a way to make it that way. I feel like that pass chart should be hung up and framed in Josh McDaniel's house
with the three dots. Yeah.
With the three dots. It's just a thing of beauty. I would laugh every time I walked by it if I was him. You mentioned Belichick and the coach rankings, right? So how do you assign some sort of metrics to decide who is a good coach, who's not a good coach? How does that come about?
I mean, Edge Sports, which is the company that owns Football Outsiders, does coach rankings on a weekly basis. And they incorporate two things. One is critical call index, which is how good the coaches are at making fourth down and two-point conversions decisions. And the other is EPI, which is how good the teams are, like how, you know, have you led a good team or not? And that being said, the fact is that there are a lot of elements of coaching that are not incorporated in those two elements, that's what you can measure. But there's a lot of coaching that you can't measure with numbers, right? Intangibles, just because I'm an analytics guy, doesn't mean I don't believe intangibles exist. I just don't try to measure them because they're intangibles. That's the definition of them, is that you can't measure them with numbers. But there is motivation. There is game planning, coming up with the right scheme for your opponent. There is managing your locker room and not letting it get out of hand. Like, these are all elements of coaching that are subjective, and you do need to consider if you're considering something like who should be coach of the year.
Who, in terms of the ways that we can tangibly measure solid coaching, who is near the top of the list this year?
Brandon Staley.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me because he's pretty consistent with, I think he feels like he's on board with analytics, right?
Absolutely. He is. I used to refer to John Harbaugh as the prince who was promised, but I think Brandon Staley may have taken over that role.
Is John Harbaugh near the top?
Yes. And so would Matt LaFleur would be near the top. And I think Sean McDermott would be also.
Okay. Who's the flip side?
Pete Carroll is terribly conservative and the Seahawks are not very good this year.
His commitment to the run. You guys don't like the commitment to the run?
It's not just that. It's that he's so conservative on fourth downs. Like, if you're such a great running team, go for it on fourth and one more often, you know? Joe Judge would be near the bottom. I think Rick Bisaccia is near the bottom. I think just since he's taken over in Oakland, Las Vegas. I'm trying to think who else is near the bottom of the league.
Where's Tomlin?
Tomlin is near the bottom. Yep, Tomlin. Tomlin is weird because when Tomlin is aggressive, it's totally random. Like, in the past, he really goes with his gut on it. So, like, you have no idea how to guess when he's going to be aggressive and when he's not, but he's been really conservative this year.
Who's the most valuable player in the NFL this year? Not who's MVP, but who's the most valuable in terms of contribution and value above replacement, things that you can measure?
I mean, I'm a believer that the most valuable player has to be a quarterback. That passing is just so much more valuable to a team than running. That the quarterback is the most important position in the game. It would take a ridiculous season from a player at another position to be more valuable than the top 10 quarterbacks in the league.
The top 10.
I guess Brady. I mean, Brady is having the best season of any quarterback in the league. And you can say, okay, sure, but look at what he gets to work with. But if you look at the other quarterbacks who are having great statistical seasons, look at what they get to work with, right? Kyler Murray gets DeAndre Hopkins and Christian Kirk to work with, and Matthew Stafford gets Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp to work with, and Dak Prescott gets Amari Cooper and CeeDee Lamb to work with. So everybody who's a top quarterback has really good receivers who we feel are talented on their own as receivers. And I think Murray would have a good argument, except that he missed three games.
Right.
And he actually has negative value running the ball this year. Some of that is because it's a surprise. Some of that is because of fumbles, some of which are blown snaps that get charged as runs but aren't really runs. But just in general, he has not had the kind of rushing value that he has had in the past. He hasn't run as much, and he hasn't run with as much success.
Did I see on your Twitter that they're fumbling like a crazy amount, but just recovering those fumbles?
Yes. I counted wrong. They actually lead the league with 21 fumbles on offense. I said 22, but I counted one on a punt by accident. They've recovered 19 of those 21 fumbles.
What? How much is that?
Totally random.
Okay, that's random.
Yep.
So is that concerning moving forward? Like, if you were to project that out, are we...
It means that the Cardinals are not as good as they look.
Oh, it doesn't mean that. Okay.
Yes. You would expect them to turn the ball over more going forward.
Is there any other way in which we're overvaluing that team, because I think a lot of people look at the Cardinals, especially the fact that they're at the top of the NFC and that they've been able to win as many games as they have in a division that we have a lot of respect for, with a lot of teams that we think are very good. And they've done that without their wide receiver one, QB one, and RB one for at least three games. They had all those guys out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very proper to think of Arizona as one of the top teams in the league this year, because you have to take out the three games without Kyler Murray when you consider their offense. And they would be higher in our ratings if we took those three games out. They're well-balanced. They're 12th in offense, even including the McCoy games, and they'd be something like sixth or something without them. They're third in defense.
That's the craziest thing about them, because I didn't expect that secondary to be particularly good this year, and then here they are.
That secondary was blech going into the year. Vance Joseph absolutely deserves consideration for coordinator of the year, what he's been able to do with that secondary. We were like, who, like, you know, Byron Murphy, like Robert Alford, has been hurt the last couple of years. Like, what are you really going to get out of him? Like, Malcolm Butler retired on them right before the season. You didn't think they were going to get anything. For them to be a top three defense with the secondary talent that they had going into the year is phenomenal.
Are there any other teams out there that your model thinks that we might be overvaluing?
I mean, the biggest one is Tennessee.
Yeah. Okay. You don't even have to explain that one to me.
Yeah. I mean, I've been Mr. Tennessee is not as good as you think they are for weeks. And then before they started losing people, now that they've lost people, they're like a wreck.
Well, the second they lost Derrick Henry, it felt to me like they won a couple of games after that, but the way in which they were winning those games was not predictive in any way of like, we're going to keep rolling these out, because the offense wasn't doing anything. So that was just a death knell, clearly indicating how important and valuable he is to that team. What is, outside of the quarterback position, the most impactful position on an NFL team, do you think?
That's tough. It probably would be wide receiver or cornerback.
Corner. Interesting. Yeah. More than like the pass rush.
Well, you have struck, you have hit upon one of the great debates of analytics.
Oh, what's that?
Which is more important, the pass rush or the secondary? And our rivals at Pro Football Focus have done some work that does seem to suggest, certainly, I don't think that it declares in such a way that you can't argue with it, but it suggests that the secondary is more important than the pass rush, that it is better to have a good secondary than to have a good pass rush. Obviously, it's better to have both.
Right.
But this is one of the great debates of modern analytics, is which is more important, the secondary or the pass rush. So with the idea that the secondary is more important than the pass rush, the cornerback would then be the most important player on defense.
How good are the Packers?
The Packers are good. The problem with the Packers in our ratings is twofold. One, they were so hideously bad in week one that, like, that's still in their rating and it drags them down. The other is they don't have
Can't you throw that out?
Well, that's the thing is, you throw that
out.
You'd
have to do that for everyone. You're right. Everyone's had a game like that.
Right.
You're right.
The other thing is they have no really great dominant game. So for example, let's say like a DVOA of 60% is a really great dominant game. Buffalo has five of those. New England has three of them. Green Bay has zero. But all of their games, except week one, come out as above average, even the losses. So all their games are good, but none of their games are great. And so that's why they're a little bit lower in our ratings than New England and Buffalo and Tampa Bay.
Is there a value? And this feels like one of those intangible things that you can't measure. Do you think that there is a value to having played all of these close games and being comfortable in those close games as you look ahead to the playoffs?
Nah, I think these are professionals. These guys have been playing football all their lives. They've all played in plenty of close games, from high school to college to the pros. I don't think having a number of close games in one year helps you at all. The fact is that the most solid indicator of a great team is blowing out your opponents, even if they're bad opponents. Obviously, the most solid indicator of a great team is blowing out good opponents. But you learn more from a blowout against a bad opponent than you do from a very, very close game against a good opponent. Like, even though we adjust for the strength of schedule, the fact is, it means a lot to be able to just destroy the Houston Texans.
Houston Texans, whose defense has gotten much better.
Yes. Shockingly, yes. Has defense is number 10 in our ratings right now. Yeah. Number 10. Yep.
Where did they start?
Oh, earlier in the season, I'd have to look it up, but they were really bad. But they've gotten much better.
I'd imagine that's a massive climb.
Their offense is the worst in the league.
Well, yeah. We could just look at the names that they're trotting out there and probably understand that. It's crazy to me. Somebody said that on the show I do on Sunday, that the Texans had the worst roster in the NFL. And I thought Lions. And then I thought, nope. It's Jets. The Texans when you start going through the names.
I don't know. I think the Jets roster is really bad.
You think it's worse than the Texans?
Yeah. I mean, the Texans, you know, all those free agents they signed were, especially like defensive free agents, were guys who could play a little bit. Like, the Jets just have like nothing. And then they went and the big free agent they signed got hurt.
Right. Maybe I'm overweighting the offensive weapons, because that's where my brain tends to go more for fantasy football purposes. But I think at least
even
on the
Jets,
case,
Houston at least has Brandon Cooks.
Yeah. And poor Brandon, man. But at least on the Jets, I feel like, you know, Corey Davis, maybe in a different situation with more around him, like he's not who I want to be there. A one in the NFL, but I think he's an okay wide receiver. And then Elijah Moore is looking like he could be a good wide receiver in the NFL, if he has a quarterback that can throw him catchable balls more frequently. Yeah, but you're right, outside of that.
The problem is, if you, we can talk about who has the worst roster, Detroit, Houston, or the Jets. But the fact is that the Jets have hope for the future, and the Lions have a little bit of hope for the future. They don't have, right, you know, as many number one picks as the Jets do, but they've got hope for the future. And the Texans have none. No hope for the future.
They have nothing there to build around.
Yeah, I mean, you don't, you know, no, I mean, no disrespect to David Culley, but you don't say that's a promising young coach the way you do about Robert Saleh. They don't have the extra draft picks. They don't have a track record of making good draft picks. They don't have a young quarterback to build around. Like, the Jets can hope that Zach Wilson is the guy. Like, the Houston is, I believe in our book, in the Football Outsiders Almanac 2021, we called them the most depressing team in the major four sports.
That's their official analytical title.
Yeah. I mean, I apologize for not knowing for sure if there's a more depressing team in the National Hockey League. The Texans are pretty bad.
Are there any teams out there that you think might be better than we think they are? Outside of San Francisco, I guess, because you already had them pretty high up in the DVOA rankings.
The incredibly frustrating Minnesota Vikings are actually 11th in our numbers. Despite the fact that they just lost to the Lions. I mean, they lost on a last second pass in a game where they outgained the Lions and won the turnover battle. So as far as like indicators for the future, that game is really not that bad. The Vikings are better than their record, but if they're going to continue to play nothing but close games and blow them in such like horrible fashion, you know, most close games are kind of the same, whether you win them or lose them. But the Vikings seem to have a really good habit of losing them. But they are better than their
What are the odds that they lose that game based on the way that the stats are? You know, if they played that game 10 times.
I have a number for that.
What's that?
I have a stat called post-game win expectancy. And it looks at the DVOA splits of a game and says, based on how well these two teams played in this game, not what we knew about them going into the game, but how well they played in this game, what would we expect to be the result? And you would expect Minnesota to win 86% of the time.
86?
Yeah.
Based on what they literally did.
Yeah.
Not based on what they have in their arsenal, but what they literally did against this team. How likely or unlikely was that last play by the Lions?
I mean, I think that Edge Sports had Minnesota as an 80% likely to win the game before the last play.
Oh, my gosh.
That was terrible. Yeah, it was terrible. And I, you know, they gave Amon-Ra St. Brown like a little bit of cushion that I felt like you've got to sit right at the edge of the goal line with him.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
clearly the defense was not what you would expect.
No.
In that situation. Okay, last question. Most improved team. Looking ahead to the future, who is building something and sneaking up in a way that might not be relevant right now, but is notable? Or is there one?
I mean, I guess that San Francisco would be the answer because everybody is of the belief that they will be better with Trey Lance at quarterback in the future than they are with Garoppolo.
Have you seen that?
The numbers don't say that.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to separate, you know, in the numbers, to separate the quality of Shanahan's scheme from the quality of the quarterback. But the people who do film work definitely feel that Garoppolo is limited. And that once Trey Lance has enough experience in the NFL, that team has a lot of young talent on both sides of the ball to really take a step forward. What they need to work on is the secondary. They need to draft some defensive backs this year. I would say that feels like the team that's on the rise. They're better than their record, and they've got this young quarterback waiting in the wings to theoretically improve them at the most important position.
Wait, I lied. I have one more question because I saw it on your Twitter and I think that it's very interesting. Cooper Kupp having a great season. I think everybody would concede if we were going to award the best wide receiver at the end of the year, we would give that award to Cooper Kupp. Who's number two? And how much of a drop off is there after that? Because there are a lot of good wide receivers in the league, right?
So we track skill players using a stat called DYAR, which is basically DVOA, but instead of comparing to average, it compares to replacement level, and it looks at your total performance, not your per play performance. Okay. We have Cooper Kupp with 422 receiving, Justin Jefferson with 416, and nobody else above 250.
That's incredible.
So Justin Jefferson is quietly having a season that is almost as good as Cooper Kupp's and way beyond what anybody else is doing.
I love the work you do, Aaron. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And I hope folks will check out footballoutsiders.com in the coming weeks. We've got lots and lots of content to get you ready for the playoffs.
Such good content there. And you can also find Aaron on Twitter, and I highly suggest you do. He's at FO_AShots. And you spell that SCHATZ. If you enjoyed this episode, I hope you did, and you want to hear more episodes of the NFL Roadshow, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow is also available on the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Just download it today, tap podcasts, up we will pop. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer. Andy King is the director of sports podcasting for SiriusXM. And a special thanks to SiriusXM's senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting, Steve Cohen. And we'll be back with another episode on Friday, taking a look at the Week 14 slate from a fantasy perspective. Some guys who have particularly good matchups, and then some low-end guys that you can maybe slide in off the waiver wire and or into your daily lineups for a low cost. That's on Friday. Hope to see you then.
SiriusXM Podcasts.